is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I used to be the guy, you know, we'd be on the road and I'd sit down at the end of the hall in the hotel and the guys would just gravitate, wind up sitting down and, you know, we could talk until 1-2 o'clock in the morning about stuff. Nobody does that with their head coach. I remember I struggled with that when I first became the head coach. There was nothing you could do about it. Like, it wasn't an indictment on me or an indictment on the kids. It was just like, yo,
right, just the way it is.
That's not your role anymore. Like, that's somebody else's job. And I try to get assistant coaches to truly understand that dynamic, I mean, that can hurt your feelings. Like, I mean, I'm, you know, hey, guys, what's up? And it's like they look at you differently because you're now the person who dictates whether they play, whether they don't play, how many shots they get. Like, you're just a different person to them. And it took me a while to accept that because, you know, I don't know, I'm going to be the coach that can do both. No, you're not.
Mike Jones has been the head coach at DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland for 17 years, where he won a national title in 2006. Mike's teams have won 9 Washington Catholic Athletic Conference regular season titles, 8 WCAC tournament crowns, 4 Maryland private school tournament championships, 6 Abe Poland city titles, and 6 Alhambra Catholic Invitational Tournament championships. Additionally, since he started as a head coach at DeMatha, Coach Jones has coached 6 athletes who went on to play in the NBA. Jones owns an all-time record at DeMatha of 469-116 for an .802 winning percentage. A standout player at Old Dominion University from 1991 through 1995, Jones was a member of the All-Colonial Athletic Association's second team and earned CAA All-Tournament Team honors in his senior season, in which he averaged 16.5 points per game. Jones led the Monarchs to the NCAA tournament in 1992 and 1995, and he capped his ODU career with 1,166 points. Following his career at Old Dominion, Jones played professionally in the CBA and the IBA, where he was an All-League First Team selection in 1997. He also played professionally in Portugal, Hong Kong, Finland, and the Dominican Republic. Mike will also serve in his 19th USA Basketball coaching role as head coach of the 2019 USA Basketball Men's U16 National Team. 3 times he previously has served as head coach of the USA Nike Hoop Summit team, including in 2013, 2014, and 2018. He also served as a USA Nike Hoop Summit assistant coach in 2012 and 2017. He got his start with USA Basketball as an assistant coach for the 2004 Youth Development Festival East team. He won 3 gold medals with USA Basketball men's junior national teams, including the 2011 U16 team and 2012 and 2016 U17 teams. He also previously worked as a coach at the annual USA Basketball men's junior national team October mini camp 8 times. If you're enjoying the show and finding some value in the Hoopheads podcast, please leave us a rating and review and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to all of our previous episodes and learn more about the show by visiting our website at www.hoopheadspod.com. You will definitely want to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Mike Jones from DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from DeMatha Catholic High School, Coach Mike Jones. Mike, welcome.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are very excited to get you on the show and dig into all the great things that you've been able to do and experience in the game of basketball. But first we want to travel back to the time when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball as a young player. So if you talk a little bit about that, that would be great.
Okay. You know, at least as far back as I can remember, you know, my parents splurged. You know, we moved to a new home somewhere around second grade, looking for something for us to do. We moved to a pretty new neighborhood. So there weren't any other kids around. They were still building houses all around us. So my dad bought a pole and a basket and put it in our front yard. And I had an older brother, almost 3 years older than me, and he was really good. So that is what, you know, initially piqued my interest. And, you know, honestly, you know, I just kind of grew up trying to be better than him. And that was a pretty finding out later on that that was a pretty good bar to set.
That's a pretty good advantage.
Yeah, I was a stubborn kid, and I refused to acknowledge he was better than me. I pretty much killed myself trying to be better than him until the day that I was. And, and that's when I found out I was a pretty decent basketball player. So, you know, being a coach at DeMatha, is pretty special to me because I went to DeMatha, played at DeMatha, and, you know, I owe a lot of who I am as a coach and as a player, or was as a player, to what I learned in my 4 years of high school. So,
talk a little bit about how you ended up going to DeMatha. Like, what was your process when you were a junior high, middle school kid, you know, in terms of where you were playing, how you were playing? Because I think the game has changed a little bit in terms of how kids go about going through their career. When kids that are my age, I'm a little bit older than you, but, you know, I spent most of my time playing on the playground, at the park, and in the driveway, as opposed to playing in a gym with the AAU system. So can you talk a little bit about what that piece of it was like leading into your decision to go to DeMatha?
Well, pretty cool for me. So, you know, I came along at a time where AAU was just becoming a thing. You know, Lester Butler was a girls' high school coach in this area, in the D.C., Maryland area, but he had a son. He had a daughter and a son. His son was my age, and he's now actually the head coach at Virginia Union University in the CIAA, a very successful program. But coach, I started a boys' team on the AAU circuit when his son got to, I believe, 11, 12 years old. And, you know, fortunately enough, they saw me play and asked if I wanted to play with them. And my team, you know, it's much different now. Back then, you know, if you had 80 teams, each state represented, you know, that was a pretty big tournament. Now you have tournaments with 1,000 teams in it. But we won the national championship for AAU as 12-year-olds. We went and qualified as 13-year-olds, but the other DC team won the national championship. And then we won again at 14 and 15-year-old. In Seattle, Washington, and Orlando, Florida, and in Kingsport, Tennessee. So, you know, my exposure to basketball, you know, through DeMatha and then through AAU was pretty cool to come along at that point in time. I wanted to go to DeMatha because, you know, in that day and age, Danny Ferry, Adrian Branch, guys like that were household names, and they all had the common denominator of going to DeMatha. And fortunately enough for me, my dad used to babysit Adrian Branch and his little brothers when they were kids. So there was a connection there. And Adrian Branch was playing with the L.A. Lakers at the time. And he would come home and drag me with him to the rec center. So, again, I fortunately very blessed to have someone of that caliber, you know, basically trying to teach me how to play the game of basketball. And, I mean, he, you know, it didn't hurt my feelings at the time because I was pretty much going to do whatever he told me. But,
right.
I mean, he literally told me, like, hey, you need to learn how to play, because I did. And I was in the eighth grade at the time. And, I mean, he never said a word about DeMatha, but I knew I wanted to be like him. So I went home and told my parents I wanted to go to DeMatha. My brother and sister both went to public school, neighborhood public school. But I told them I wanted that opportunity, and they, I guess, talked about it and then said, hey, if you want to do this, you can. We'll sacrifice to put you in that position. But, I mean, basically, this is on you. And, you know, I tell my kids all the time, my parents never checked my homework. My parents, you know, came to meet my teachers, but they, you know, if I had an issue, it was almost like they looked at me like, you better figure it out. You know, I had issues with a coach. It wasn't, hey, let's go talk to the coach. It was like, hey, you wanted to do this, like, you better make it work. And, you know, at some point in time, I understood what they were trying to do. They were trying to get me to, first of all, take ownership of whatever was going to happen to me. But then also, they truly trusted the teachers and the coaches I had, regardless of whether or not I felt like something was fair or unfair. They trust the adults in my life. And, you know, nowadays, that's something that's so rare. But, you know, it's something that definitely, I think, would help kids a lot. So anyway, that's how I was the 16th man on a 16-man freshman team, but things worked out. I worked really hard, and I had a good attitude, and, you know, I got better fast because
what was
I
your
was
first
around other really good players and coaches.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when you surround yourself with other really good players, and obviously it sounds like from your AAU experience and then on into DeMatha, you had that opportunity, and we all know that that's how you improve and get better. What was your first impression of Coach Wooten when you first met him, and what do you remember about those early days at DeMatha with him?
The biggest thing was, like, everyone was in awe of him. In eighth grade, I did go visit DeMatha, sat in a practice, actually talked to the football coach, didn't even get a chance to talk to Coach Wooten because of practice. But just, I mean, he was just this person who you just immediately had a tremendous amount of respect for. I mean, his reputation spoke for itself. And I felt honored just to be in the gym and watch his practice and his players and watch them play. But, and it was just, freshman, sophomore year to have to say your name was like gold. hey, Mike, how you doing? I mean, I was just like, oh, my gosh, coach just spoke to me. And, yeah, it was just something that I will never forget that experience. I learned so much from him as a player and as a coach. But, you were scared to say two words to him. If he spoke to you, you kind of said hi. And it was like, pretty girl speaking to you.
So. Totally understand. What do you remember that you took away from your time playing for him? I want to just throw a coach question at you, and then we'll come back to the playing piece of it. What things or did you take away from him as a coach that you've incorporated into your coaching style?
Well, the one thing I think, coach had many qualities, but I think the most impressive thing about him is that he always coached his team. And what I mean is he had a system, but he was always willing to adjust. I mean, to be able to coach across five decades was and be as successful as he was absolutely amazing. The reason why he was able to do that was because of his ability to just adjust to who he had on his team. And, that's the one thing I took away. Like, you could go year to year and never play the same way. And he would always add things or say, hey, that worked last year. Let's do something different this year because the personnel was different. So
I think most good coaches, especially nowadays, it's so, I don't want to say easy isn't the right word, but there's so many more resources out there in terms of whether it's coaching clinics or what you can find online or, the ability to connect with other coaches from all over the place allows you to, I think, gain more knowledge than maybe a coach, 30 or 40 years ago. I think it was more rare when you had somebody like Coach Wooten that would adjust year to year because people just weren't aware of what other coaches were doing as much as they are today. So if you think back to your time when you were there and you started, when did you know that you were going to have an opportunity to play college basketball? Like when you were the 16th man on a 16 man freshman team, what were your thoughts in terms of you were just, yeah, I'm sure, trying to worry about getting on the floor in high school, let alone worried about college. But when did it become apparent to you that you might have an opportunity to play beyond college?
I mean, or beyond high school? I don't know if I attribute this to just young people or the math of young people. But honestly, as soon as I made the team, I mean, you automatically assume that, hey, I'm going to college for free and I'm going to play 10 years in the NBA. I mean, that's just the confidence of young people. And it's still to this day. I mean, you can have a kid on your team that doesn't play every game, but he still thinks that, Duke should be offering him a scholarship. So, yeah, I knew I was going to get better. So, but I honestly believed that from the time that I was good enough to make the team. And I can remember my dad asking me my freshman, what are you going to do if you get cut? And I mean, obviously my motivation for going to DeMath was basketball. My answer to him was, well, I guess I'll just work harder and try out again as a sophomore. And I think that's what he really wanted to hear from me, because again, they were making a huge sacrifice to pay the tuition for me to go there. And I think he just wanted to know that I was truly committed to it. And honestly, I think my dad was also realistic, like, hey, you're not that good, and like, what these other guys are, so what are you going to do? But it worked out. And honestly, like I said, from the time I met, basically I started paying attention to colleges because I'm like, that's what's and fortunately I worked hard enough to be able to earn that. So
talk about what you did, let's say, in your off season. Obviously, during the season, you're improving and getting better, but we all know that a lot of individual improvement for players happens in the off season. So can you talk a little bit about what you did in the off seasons while you were in high school to really get your game up to the level that you felt that it would need to be able to continue to play?
Well, I learned something very early on in freshman basketball team tryouts my freshman year. I couldn't make a left-hand layup. Guess pretty much everybody else could. Or at least the guys that, let's say, were in the top 30 players trying out. And we probably had 100 kids try out. But when we got down to the top 30, I remember we were warming up. And every time on the left-hand side, I would shoot a right-handed layup. And I guess I'd been able to get away with it up until that point. And the coach stopped. And he, said something to me. Hey, you got to, on the left hand, you got to shoot. On the left-hand side, you got to shoot with your left hand. And next time I went, I tried to get away with shooting with my right. And so then he really stopped everything and made everybody stop and said, and they used to call me Jonesy. He's like, Jonesy, go, I want you to make a left-handed layup. So I went in and it was awful. So he basically stopped practice and said, hey, we're not doing another thing until Jonesy makes a left-handed layup. And that was the most brutal thing ever, because I couldn't do it. I had no confidence in it. After missing one or two, then it's like, oh crap. So finally I make it, and I vowed that I would never be put in that position again. So by January of that same season, like, I was like literally doing almost everything with my left hand. Like, I'd really, like, after practice, before practice, on the weekends, like, whatever opportunity I had to work on my left hand, I would. And the funny thing is, when I worked out with Adrian Branch, he used to tell me the same thing, and I didn't get it.
Didn't sink in.
So it took that point. Yeah, I mean, it took that embarrassment, basically, to get me to do it. And I knew that there's definitely things that I didn't do well, and I needed to pick something. So every offseason, I just picked two things and said, hey, these are the things I'm going to get better at. I was a really skinny kid, and it took me a while to realize that strength was going to be important. So I really didn't focus on that until going into my senior year. But my outside shooting, my ball handling, being able to, my godfather put me in a jump rope class one year just to make sure that I got my foot speed and agility a whole lot better with a bunch of old ladies at the local middle school. And I used to, like, literally leave there and then go to the playground and play. And guys would be like, yo, why are you late? And I was just too embarrassed. I was basically with a bunch of senior citizens in a jump rope class. But to be honest with you, it was one of the best things I ever did for my game, because I became a much, much better defensive player because of my ability to move my feet. But I mean, that was just me in the off season. And again, that work ethic and, like, things like that have definitely transferred into coaching. And, you know, I can tell when guys are really putting in that work in the off season. And, you know, I have a different relationship with those guys that are willing to do that, you know, without being told, the guys that are self-starters.
Yeah, I think that's the key for any kid who's really going to make a leap from year to year, is, are they willing to do it on their own? And it's one of the challenges that I think high school coaches face all over the country is, you know, how do we get our kids, you know, how do we get our kids? How do we motivate them? How do we get them in the gym? And to your point, I think the best kids are the ones still that you don't have to motivate them, that they are motivated by themselves and they want to be self-starters. They want to get out and improve and get better. Most of the time when you were working out, were you with Adrian? Were you by yourself in a gym? What was your process like?
Oh, it was just he and I. I mean, he would come pick me up. Usually it would be like around 11 o'clock or noon during the week when the rec centers didn't have many people in it. And I mean, it was in the summertime, so, you know, guys were off doing so many other things. He used to make me, again, the whole left-handed thing. We used to play one-on-one, full court. He wasn't allowed to shoot inside the three-point line, and I had to do everything on the left side floor, and, you know, other than shoot the ball. And yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was
fun. I had a similar opportunity with Scott Roth, who played at Wisconsin, played a couple years in the NBA, and he's coaching the Iowa Wolves G League team. And Scott is probably, I don't know, he's probably 6 or 7 years older than me. And one day, I told this story before, but I was at the park. I was like 14, and it was the middle of the summer, so it was like a 85, 90 degree day, and I was out there. I was the only person on the court by myself, and Scott pulls up in his car, gets out of the car, and said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to play one-on-one full court with me. You know, are you interested? And Scott grew up in the area around where, you know, where I grew up, so I had seen him play when he was in high school and obviously knew who he was, and I'm like, absolutely. And, you know, he was just looking for somebody that could run, that had some stamina, that would, you know, that would go up and down the court with them and play one-on-one. And I mean, I really attribute a lot of that, you know, the success that I was able to have with, you know, him kind of taking me under his wing and working out with me and doing those kinds of things. And so it sounds like your experience was similar in that way, that Adrian was able to do that for you. And it's just, you know, again, it's one of those things that you don't expect it to happen, and you kind of look back, and in a way, I always feel like it's kind of amazing that, you know, how did this guy find me of all people? And, you know, here we are, then we were working out, and it ended up being such a tremendous benefit to me in my playing career. And then on in, just like you said, developing that work ethic and, you know, having that apply across all walks of life.
Yep.
Very cool. Yep. So how'd you end up at, so
definitely
tell the story.
A blessing.
Yep. Tell the story of how you ended up at Old Dominion.
pretty cool for me. So going into my senior year, I had Virginia Tech, Radford, and VMI as the three main schools that were recruiting me. And basically, I was prepared to take a visit to all three. I don't think I was Virginia Tech's first choice, but I was definitely Radford's choice and VMI's choice. And I visited Radford and VMI and almost committed to VMI. And again, I didn't think I was Virginia Tech's first choice, but definitely, I mean, that was a big time program, loved the coaching staff. And but I decided to wait until the spring to commit, just to see if I got more options. I think Coach Wooten was, I'm not going to say he wanted me to do that, but he was very much supportive of me doing that. And at the end of the year, my season, and at the end of the college basketball season, the head coach at Radford got the head coaching job. He hired the top assistant that recruited me at VMI, and he hired the top assistant that recruited me at Virginia Tech. Though I still had all those options on the table, like, it just made perfect sense. It was like, okay, so the three people that I had the best relationship with that I really considered their schools, now they're all in the same place. Like, this is pretty much a no-brainer. I have to do this, and I committed. Yeah, and I mean, but honestly, I sat on the bench my first 2 years. I know I remember my sophomore year sitting in my dorm room at the end of the year, looking at stats, and I played one more minute my sophomore year than I did my freshman year. And, you know, in that day and age, especially now, but in that day and age, I was like, yo, you need to transfer. You need to leave.
Right.
But, you know, that thought came into my mind, but I never really seriously considered it. I wound up starting games as a junior, and I wound up being second leading scorer, all-conference performer as a senior, and, you know, was able to play after college because, I believe because I stuck it out. It was a coaching change between my junior and senior year, so I wound up having to do it for two different coaches. And Oliver Purnell was my coach my first 3 years, you know, who I still lean on as a mentor and definitely somebody that I look up to. And then Jeff Capel, senior, was the coach my senior year, and I owe him so much. And rest in peace. You know, he passed away last year. I cannot remember this ever happening. But he came in, and he literally, most coaches in that situation, the seniors are like an afterthought.
Right.
Like, you need to build your program with your guys. And, like, it's almost like the seniors, like, hey, I'm not going to take your scholarship from you, but, hey, you know, you're not going to play. And he did the exact opposite. Me and my two other senior classmates, I mean, he treated us like we were family. And I had other friends that went through the same thing at other schools, and it was a disaster. And I'm still beholden to his family just because that situation could have been handled so much differently. And I'm just so thankful for him that my college experience ended the way it did. I mean, my senior year, we make it to the NCAA tournament, beat Villanova in the first round in triple overtime, and like one of the greatest NCAA games in history. And we're like, you know, I'm in the middle of all of that when I could have been sitting at the end of the bench pouting because the guy's going with the younger guy. So,
yeah, that's a great lesson. I love the thought that you had when you're sitting there as a sophomore and you're like, man, I'm not playing. And, you know, I think today you probably, just by virtue of peer pressure and the people around you, would have been a lot more likely probably to transfer out at that point. Cause everybody, I mean, we all know how big the transfer list is. Yep. You know, the D1 transfer list right now is ridiculous. The number of guys that transfer out, and we can talk a little bit about that later in terms of the way that the recruiting process goes and all that stuff. But I think it's a testament to you, and it's a testament to sort of, you know, the idea of perseverance and sticking with it, and the fact that, you know, you were willing to stick it out and then eventually got an opportunity. And it wasn't really the opportunity that you thought, because you ended up with a completely new coaching staff, which, as you said, sometimes throws the whole thing into a state of uncertainty. And so the fact that you were able to overcome all that and still come out of it with having, you know, great success in your career and coming out with two guys who you have tremendous respect for as your coaches, you know, I think that speaks a lot to what you were able to accomplish, and that you probably did, thinking back to when you first decided to go there, you probably did end up in the right spot despite the fact that there were some hardships along the way.
Absolutely. And if you look at it this way, I mean, I was so unhappy playing time wise my freshman and sophomore year. And then finally my junior year, there's a breakthrough. Like, one of the guys that played in front of me actually unfortunately got into a car accident the summer before my junior year. And he was okay, but he was not himself after that. And it took him a full season to kind of get back. So it opened up a tremendous opportunity for me to play, and I fully took advantage of it. But, you know, again, I mentioned I was really stubborn before, and you know, it's I use these experiences all the time as a coach now. But like, you know, I honestly at some point in time, you know, I it was personal. It was like, you know, why isn't he playing me? Like, this,
right.
This sucks. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. Like, this isn't fair. All of that stuff. And, you know, finally my junior year, I get to play. And then he takes a job somewhere else. And I'm just like, yo, that's I felt betrayed. I'm just
right,
like, yo,
absolutely.
I persevered through 2 years. I didn't leave. Like, you know, I was mad about it, but like I fought through and clearly we had great success my junior year. And then you're just going to turn and go somewhere else. Like, I thought it was so unfair. I was mad at him like so much. And then again, my expectation was a new coach is going to come in and like he's not going to take care of me. He's not going to look out for me. So but again, it all worked out. And again, these are like you mentioned, just, you know, that guy pulling up and asking if you wanted to play. Like, I mean, it's just me. It's just all, you know, evidence that, you know, there's definitely a higher power that's looking out and, you know, just arranging things for people to be able to take advantage of. And I just feel truly blessed.
Yeah, for sure. What do you remember about that freshman, sophomore year time when you weren't playing, getting through kind of the day to day? Because I know I my experience when I played and I played at Kent, you know, I was able to, I didn't play very much as a freshman at all. And then when I was a sophomore, I kind of had the breakthrough that you had as a junior. But my freshman year, I know, was very, very tough. And, you know, I had to figure out ways to kind of continue to motivate yourself. Cause obviously if you're that good of a player, you've spent the first 18 years of your life playing as much as you want, pretty much doing everything you want. And now suddenly you come into an environment where you can't do that and you're not getting an opportunity to play. And so I just remember every day having to kind of, you know, look and plot out the future of, okay, here's where my opportunity is going to lie. Here's where this guy's going to maybe transfer, or this guy's going to graduate, or I, you know, I can beat this guy out by improving on this. So what do you remember about that time? Just what your mentality was when you were on the bench?
Well, I think my freshman year, you know, it's, and especially again in that day and age, you know, people stayed 4 years. I kind of expected it. You know, I was coming from being more of an inside guy in high school to being a guard in college. So there was that adjustment. And then the fact that I was young. So, and I was going to a program where, I mean, the guys were pretty good. So I kind of understood it. But the most frustrating part was, like, I got a lot better. And I was just proofing the workouts I had. I got a lot better, but only playing one more minute. And I do remember the first time I went through not playing at all. Like, just, I didn't get 1 second on the court. I missed practice the next day. And, you know, typical. Again, I think about all of these things when I go through with our kids now.
Right, right.
I missed practice the next day because I was, quote, unquote, sick. I wasn't feeling well. And coaches can handle that so many different ways. Like, I'm sure they knew exactly what was up. Like, he's pouting.
Right.
Like, and they could have just let me be. They could have sent a senior captain or something and like, yo, go talk to Mike and just, you know, make sure. They could have been like, hey, screw him. Like, if he's not tough enough to handle this, like, yo, he's not good enough to play. And if he doesn't understand that, that's on him. And Coach Purnell didn't do any of those things. Like, he didn't send an assistant coach. He didn't send a captain. Like, he literally that night came to my dorm room. I remember I was in the bed, lights off, like probably listening to slow music, all depressed and everything. And he came in, knocked on my door. And just said, hey, just wanted to check on you, make sure you're all right. And I said, yeah, I think I'll be feeling better tomorrow. And basically, with the wink, wink, like, look, dude, I know you're not sick. But look, we've all been here. Like, yo, just make sure you come in with the right mindset tomorrow. Like, you got to keep fighting. I'm not here to tell you you're going to play more or anything like that. But I'm telling you, you're moving in the right direction. And he had a way of communicating all of that to me without basically justifying, you know, the pretty much poor decision that I made to miss practice.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, I listened to him and, you know, showed up the next day. And then again, it didn't change my playing time. I still didn't play. But again, I think, again, looking back on my experience, I really respect him for that because he could have, I mean, there's 15 different ways he could have handled it. And he chose the one that I truly believe was the best one.
Yeah, the best one for you as a kid. And I think those are the kinds of things that, you know, that's a lesson that you learn that obviously it's tangentially related to basketball, but it wasn't a direct basketball lesson. And sometimes those life lessons that we can teach as coaches are the things that, you know, really make the biggest impact. And, you know, you're still feeling the effects of that story, you know, 25 years later. And that's something that I think we all we all know as coaches that we have that kind of impact, but sometimes in the day-to-day, you kind of forget about that or maybe get lost in, you know, what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And it's important to kind of go back and reflect and think about those experiences that you've had in the game, whether it's as a player, what you've done earlier in your career as a coach, and just remember the kind of impact that you're able to make on kids at such a, you know, at such a delicate time in their life, whether you're a high school coach and you're dealing with the, you know, 14, 15, 16, or you're a college coach and you're dealing with the, you know, 18, 19, 20 year old guy. It's just everybody's impressionable at those ages, and the decisions that you make as a coach, again, they have long lasting impact. I mean, I can just tell from talking to you, and I know my own stories, that, you know, those things are things that I'm going to be 85 years old and still telling those stories and still thinking about the impact that they had on me. And it's kind of amazing what basketball and sports are able to do for people.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So many things can be taught. You know, I know we haven't talked about the USA basketball experience, but this past weekend at the Final Four, we had our mini camp, and former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan came through and spoke to the guys. And, you know, he's a Harvard grad, you know, and obviously been, you know, part of a presidential cabinet. And he said all the best lessons he's learned in life has been through the game of basketball. Hasn't always dealt with basketball, but it's been through the game of basketball, and especially with working with others and fighting through adversity and things like that. And I mean, sitting there back and listening, even as an adult now, like, I mean, those things are so.
Yeah, it has a great impact. I got to hear, he was at the Junior NBA Leadership Conference last spring in Chicago, and he was on one of the panels, and I got a chance to hear him talk. And he talked at that time kind of about just how the system of basketball, he was such a bigger fan of the way he grew up, which was on the playgrounds and, you know, playing with his friends in the neighborhood and not so much having to. And then he was talking about driving his kids around to these different AAU tournaments and all this. It was interesting just to hear, again, somebody who's attained the level of success that he's been able to attain, just talk about his experience in the game and relay just how much of an impact he felt like the game of basketball had on him and all the things, just like you said, that he learned growing up and figuring out how to play with his friends on the, you know, on the driveway or at the playground. It's just
figuring out how to play with the president. Probably.
Yeah. That was probably the most delicate balance. You got to figure out, you know, do you take Obama down?
Don't foul that guy.
Do you back off? You know, or just, that's gotta be tough. If you're competitive, you gotta want to beat him.
Do you remember, did you ever watch him play in the celebrity games? He won the MVP one time. And I was like, he wasn't messing around, man.
No, he was not. He was taking everything serious, which doesn't surprise me.
Well, pretty cool for me is he went to Harvard. One of my former assistant coaches played on the same Harvard team as he did. And then when he was here in the D.C. area, his younger son, Ryan, came to our basketball camp at least one week every summer. So, you know, so I had somewhat of a relationship with him. It's pretty cool. You're, 7:30 in the morning. And you knew Mr. Duncan was like, the mom usually dropped off and picked up, but you knew Mr. Duncan was there when the guy walked in with the earpiece and did sweep the building first. And then he walked back out the door. And then like literally 15 seconds later, Mr. Duncan would walk in with Ryan. Like you always knew when he was getting ready to show up.
Yeah, so. That's very cool. Those are experiences that from a basketball standpoint, you can't even begin to describe to people who aren't involved in it, just, you know, the opportunities that it affords you from just, I think about your story that you told about being a 12-year-old and going and being able to travel for the national AAU tournaments, just to be able to be exposed to those kinds of things as a kid, are tremendous. And then obviously you've gotten to do some great things, which we'll get to here eventually, you know, with the USA basketball stuff. And I want to talk a little bit about your overseas professional career, because like I told you before we jumped on the show, one of the things that we like to talk to anybody who had a chance to play overseas is what's your best overseas basketball story, because universally everybody has one. We've got some good ones, Mike, so you're gonna have to come up with something good if you want to top the list. So let's go there. Yeah. Tell us your best overseas basketball story.
I mean, I think I have a few. I think one, just to give people a perspective, how cutthroat it is. So I was fortunate. I signed as a free agent with the Indiana Pacers the summer after my senior year of high school. Pretty much, again, you know, delusional. I thought, hey, I'm going to play 10 to 15 years.
Right.
I had a pretty good tryout with them. Guys like Reggie Miller, you know, Mark Jackson, those guys. And then they drafted Fred Hoiberg and Travis Best. So, I mean, the writing was on the wall. Like, they weren't going to – I mean, I had to be really good for a free agent to take one of the spots of one of their draft picks. So, I wound up playing in Finland first. I played in the Dominican Republic. I played in Portugal. And then I played in what is now part of the G League, was once the CBA, the IBA in North Dakota. Best story. So, in Finland, first of all, I mean, you're talking about basically playing at the North Pole. It's absolutely freezing. Like, and I hear people complain about how cold it is, and I'm just like, you have no idea how cold can get. I mean, I literally, like, you know, and everything over there was centigrade, not Fahrenheit, but, like, I don't remember seeing the ground. Like, it was always snow and ice everywhere, and, like, never melts. So it was freezing over there. Well, I didn't ski, and I don't think they would allow me to ski. But one of my teammates, like, you know, riding in a car with him and watching him, like, he used to mess with me. They didn't parallel park. Like, he literally, if the parking spot was on the left side of the street and he was driving on the right side of the street, he would literally slam on brakes, pull his emergency brake up, and turn the wheel and let the car slide, flip around and slide into a spot. And he never hit anything. And I was so amazed, like, at that. But again, the cutthroat part. So one game we're playing, I won't say the American's name, but he played at one of the Blue Bloods, and he's playing on the ops. And, you know, this is a playoff implication game. And his team, like, they're fighting for, like, the second seed or the first seed, and we're fighting to just make sure we're in the playoffs. And, like, we play the same position, but he's guarding me, but I am not guarding him. His team was good enough. They didn't have to do that. My team, I couldn't get in foul trouble, so our coach would not allow me to guard the other American until the second half of the games. And at halftime, I had 32 points. At halftime, he had 26 points. But we were winning at half. So we come out of the locker room for the second half, and this is at his place. We're on the road, they're at home. We come out at halftime, and he's not on the floor, which was weird. And then I look over on the bench, and he's not on the bench either. And, like, literally 6-7 minutes into the half, I look over, and he's walking out of the locker room in street clothes with his bag over his shoulder. And I look at him and kind of give him the, yo, what's up? And he gives me the axe sign across the neck. He's like, yo, he got cut. Like, he literally got cut at halftime. And
oh, my God.
I know that franchise was going through something at the time where they were, like, you know, I don't know, losing money or whatever. But, like, it was very to be one of the better teams in the league that year. And I guess when they went in, they blamed it on him that it wasn't happening because of, you know, they were losing at halftime. And the guy you're guarding is, like, killing. But, I mean, again, I had 32, he had 26. Like, I mean, it's not like he wasn't playing well.
That's rough. You get cut with 26 points at halftime. You're getting cut.
Oh, my God.
That's rough.
Gosh. So I'm sitting there like, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders. But that was my first year. This was like his fourth or fifth year. So he kind of shrugged it off. Like, I mean, he knew. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. And, like, I had never, like, I'm just like, wow. And I'm like, shit, my team is barely, you know, we might make the playoffs. Like, you know, what's up with my job? And, like, when do I need to start looking over my shoulder? So that's probably, just in terms of how ruthless and cutthroat it can be over there, that's probably one of the worst stories I could give you.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just, I mean, from just the playing circumstances to getting paid to the language barrier to all this stuff.
Don't get me started.
You had to chase down. You had to chase down some paychecks.
Hey, I came home for Christmas that same season. Went back. I almost thought about not going back, but I went back. But I took my dad with me. He had just retired from a government job. Took my dad with me. I could not wait for the season to be over. So, like, literally, our last game was a Friday night. I was on a plane Saturday morning. But I didn't have – and so the club thought, oh, but shoot, well, once he's gone, like, hey, we don't have to pay. My dad stayed in our apartment, and every day he'd go to the team headquarters, and they'd say, hey, come back on this day. He'd go back. And it took – he probably stayed for another 6 weeks. And he'd say, hey, I got some of the money. And I'd be like – and I was like, look, man, you come back when you want to. He's like, no, I'm staying until they give him. He stayed and stayed until it took 6 weeks. And they would, like, I think maybe three different payments, but he finally returned with every dime.
That's crazy.
And that was, it was pretty cool because, honestly, I was so frustrated. I was just like, yeah, I just want to go home. And then one other quick story. So I played in the Dominican Republic, and down there is a little bit different. You know, we had armed security guards at the end of our bench, barbed wire on the fencing behind our bench, and security guards with, you know, I'll say AK-47s. I have no idea what kind of gun it was, but it sounds cool.
Right.
But like literally would stand the entire game facing the crowd with their back. Like, and I used to think like, yo, what if he gets bumped into with his fingers on the track? I mean, he would not even know the ball's coming or a player's coming or anything, like they were trained to just stand in there and like, because they would, you know, I'm sure you've heard, like, they would heat pennies and throw them at you at the free throw line.
Oh, yeah, for sure, so right. Batteries and all kind of stuff, and coins.
Yeah, like, all of that crap. So they, like, literally, at the end of each bench was an armed, like, military person, like, that was, and obviously, I don't know what would have happened had somebody done it. I mean, he was armed, and he looked like, you know,
he was ready to, like, he was ready to use it, right?
In England. Yeah, yep. No smile staring into the crowd, so.
All right, so which country of the ones that you played in, which one was your favorite?
Portugal by far.
What'd you like about it?
So I played in Lisbon. I played for Benfica, which is a huge soccer team. You know, I believe 90,000 seat soccer stadium. And then underneath the stadium was a 4,500 seat basketball stadium. But, well, basketball arena, gym, whatever you want to call it. The weather was great. The women were gorgeous. I lived like basically a 10-minute drive from the beach, a 20-minute drive to the casino. Got in trouble, but this, I was really into golf at that time. And me and two of my teammates basically bought golf memberships, but not knowing that our head coach was a member of the same club. And I guess every time we went there, they would tell him to the point where they basically, and I don't believe it was in our contract first. I believe they added it in there and then showed it to us. But we weren't supposed to be doing that. And I was just like, well, like, is somebody going to give me my money back for my membership? And they were just like, no. Like, so, I mean, it was like, yo, you can go there and sit by the pool and enjoy all the other amenities, but you're not, like, you guys, you're not supposed to be doing another sport while you're under contract with us. So, but I love Portugal. I went through three cars. I had a three-bedroom apartment. I mean, everything about that place was just awesome. The food was the best out of any of the places that I, the people were really nice. I had a ball.
You didn't like the girls in parkas and boots at, you know, in Finland?
Well, the females were very friendly in Finland. The guys, like, looked at you like, you know, like you were just stolen from them. So, but in Portugal, everybody was nice. It didn't matter.
Gotcha.
Male, female.
Gotcha.
Old. Like, they were all great.
Understood. All right, let's jump from playing. Let's jump into coaching. And when did you know or think that coaching might be a direction that you wanted to head? Was it something that was always kind of in the back of your mind as you were growing up? Or was it something that when you got done playing and you kind of looked around and said, man, I want to stay involved in the game. How did coaching come to be such a big part of your life?
Well, I knew I kind of told myself that whenever, again, after that 10, 15-year NBA career, I was going to be a coach. And whenever I stopped playing, I want to coach. And Coach Wooten's son and I graduated together from DeMatha played on, and we used to always talk about, you know, in the future coaching together. I knew I wanted to be a coach just from my days in high school. And, I mean, I guess you can attribute that to Coach Wooten being around him. And then like I mentioned before, my AAU coach was such a huge influence on me. Like, I was lucky to have those guys, and I wanted to be like them.
So you get done playing. What's the process for starting your coaching career? When does it become apparent that Coach Wooten's going to step down, that you may have an opportunity to go back and coach at DeMatha? Just describe the how that whole thing came to be. Because obviously, I mean, there's a lot of layers there. One, just as a legendary coach stepping down and you stepping into those shoes, obviously that's something that a lot of people might sort of not be that excited about, man. That's a lot to live up to. So just kind of talk about the process of how that came to be and what your mentality was at that time.
Well, the one thing is, like, I'm not going to go too far because I do plan to write a book.
Okay. Nice.
Actually, relatively soon, that will have a lot of that stuff, because the whole transition from when Coach Wooten was the coach to him retiring to me being the coach, there's a lot, like you said, layers. There's a ton of layers to that. So, I mean, I'm not going to, not talk about it, but
Understood. Absolutely.
But fortunately enough for me, and again, I keep, using the word blessed. I mean, I truly was blessed because the second to my last year of playing, the principal at DeMatha, after talking with Coach Wooten, they wanted to hire me. I got my degree in human services and counseling. They had an opening in the counseling center at DeMatha, and they wanted me to come and be a counselor at the school, and obviously to make sure that I would be able to coach. So they had arranged that. I actually went in and interviewed and actually thought about not playing my final year, which I didn't know was my final year, but that last year that I played. But right after, basically, I interviewed and I, basically was ready to take the job, I got a call to go play. So I was just like, and the fact is, I didn't immediately say no. So I was just like, it's not out of my system. So I went and played one more year. And then fortunately enough, the next summer, the same opportunity existed again because another opening had opened up in the counseling center. So I accepted the job then. I had gotten injured in my last season of playing. And it just made that much of an easier decision because I wasn't going to be playing anytime soon anyway. So I go and I coach. I'm an assistant coach on the freshman basketball team, my first year. And yeah, I loved it. I loved the kids. I loved, I had a ton of experiences to kind of draw off of, and just being around Coach. And then the following year, I was the head freshman coach and assistant varsity coach, and I did that for 3 years. After the second year, I was just assistant varsity coach. I didn't coach the freshman team anymore. And then that's when it gets kind of crazy. So my first year there, Coach Wooten's son was still the coach, was still a coach on Coach Wooten's staff. I believe at that point in time, so 3 years before he retired, Coach knew he wanted to step down. And the big thing was who was going to be his replacement. And I think everyone just assumed that it would be his son.
Right.
And, without going into too much detail, it wasn't going to be a home run. Like, that was, it was found out, I guess, that there wasn't going to be that seamless transition. And there were going to be some hoops that had to be jumped through. So, for lack of a better way of saying it, Joe, Coach Wooten's son, decided, there was an opportunity at another school, and he decided to take that opportunity instead of sticking around. And I think Coach was still going to retire, but then now, like, there is no no-brainer as who the next person is going to be. And, like, this is getting ready to get really messy, to where the families of, we had a really good sophomore class getting ready to be juniors that year. Or no, they were freshmen getting ready to be sophomores. And those families got together and basically said, look, when we decided to come here, we came here because you were going to be our son's coach. And they basically begged him to stay until their kids graduated. So that meant 3 more years. And I, to hear Coach Wu talk about it, like, he reluctantly won a lot more games with them. And I think he knew he was going to retire. And again, blessed and thankful to him, he decided to go through the whole summer, the whole fall. I mean, he alerted our school principal that, hey, I might be, calling it quits. I'm not telling you that I am. Basically, you guys need to have a plan in place just in case I decide to do this. So they got us together and they figured out that, hey, if Coach were to retire, Mike Jones would be the interim coach in that first season, because I think Coach basically told them, hey, if I retire, I'm going to do it right before the season starts. Like, yeah. And obviously the thought there was they won't be able to have a national search. They won't be able to do all these interviews. You'll have to hire somebody from within.
Right.
And the decision was made that that would be me. And then 2 days before the season started on November 6th, 2002, he retired. He comes into my office the night before and says, hey, can we talk? And he was like, yeah, like, you know, this is going to be it. Obviously I knew exactly what that meant at the time. And, the next morning there's a press conference and, it was pretty cool because, it's a high school job. Like, who has a press conference? But I think everybody across everywhere. I mean, USA Today was there, a couple of national, I think Nightline reported on it. Like, it was, people everywhere to hear Coach say that he was stepping aside. So, then I was thrown into the fire.
You were on.
I was off, but I was on. we started the season that first year. We started 8-0. I'm thinking like, this is a piece of cake. We're talented. And we finished that year 15-17. And forget, Coach Wooten always won 20 games. Forget finishing 500. At around DeMatha, I think a lot of people looked at it like, man, the guy was too young. He wasn't ready, number one. Number two, Coach Wooten was, the glue that held everything together. Like, DeMatha will never be the same. There was a lot of reasons for DeMatha to definitely hire somebody else. But, again, fortunately and blessed enough that they believed in me, and Coach Wooten fought for me and a couple of other, pretty important people in our school community pushed for me to get the job. One of them, mainly my former boss, the principal of the school, John Moylan, they basically fought to make sure that I could be given a real chance. And they did give it to me. And, we've been pretty good since then. So
I'd say it turned out pretty good.
Yeah, so far.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
So what that first year, what do you remember as being your biggest challenge or challenges that first year when you took over? Obviously, taking over 2 days before the season, you kind of, it sounds like, had some inkling that that was a possibility that it was going to happen. But just thinking back to that time compared to where you are now, what were some of the challenges that you faced that first year?
I think, there's so many of them. I think one of the things that I always think about is my relationship, and I the relationship I had with the kids. I have a ton of assistant coaches now, and a lot of them want to one day have their own program. And I, it's funny, I used to be the guy, we'd be on the road and I'd sit down at the end of the hall in the hotel, and the guys would just gravitate, wind up sitting down, and we could talk until 1-2 o'clock in the morning about stuff. Nobody does that with their head coach. That's always assistant coach.
Exactly.
And I remember I struggled with that when I first became the head coach, because all those relationships went out the window, and like, there was nothing you could do about it. Like, it wasn't an indictment on me or an indictment on the kids. It was just like,
right,
that's
the way it
not
is.
Your role anymore. Like, that's somebody else's job. And I try to get assistant coaches to truly understand that dynamic. I mean, that could hurt your feelings. Like, I'm, hey, guys, what's up? And it's like they look at you differently because you're now the person who dictates whether they play, whether they don't play, how many shots they get. Like, you're just a different person to them. And it took me a while to accept that because, I know I'm going to be the coach that can do both. No, you're not. Like, that's just not the way it works. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing being just the respect level. And again, I'm not speaking poorly of parents or officials, but there was a certain level of respect that Coach Wooten just, like, he didn't ask for it. It just was. I mean, he earned it over his career.
Over a long
referees
time.
Referees treated him one way. Parents knew not to approach him with, you know, nonsense about playing time and things like that. He had his rules. He had his methods, and no one messed with that. Well, it's almost like the teacher's gone, the substitute's there, and I'm, you know, technically the substitute now. Like, they're going to try everything. Referees didn't want to talk to me. It was like, no, that's the call. Sit down, shut up. Like, you know, parents like, hey, no, we're going to talk about playing time. And I'm just like, no, we don't do that. And, oh, yes, we are. And it's just like I had to earn the respect of the basketball community. You know, there was no hiding behind the name DeMath or the name Wooten anymore. Like, this, it was me. And it, I mean, that was tough. Like, it was some, definitely some very long nights my first couple of years. But eventually we got to the point where, you know, that trust was earned. And, you know, my staff and I, we laugh about it all the time because it's a big difference. And I don't look at myself as an old guy. I'm 45 now. And the kids look at me like I'm a dinosaur, but right, you know, I've been coaching. It seemed like it's been 17 years. It seems like I'm still young. I can still move. I can still joke. I listen to a lot of the same music those guys listen to. But the respect level that we now have as a staff and me as a coach, just really, it's night and day. And it just obviously it makes things so much easier. So
yeah, when did you feel like you had that piece of it? You know, obviously it's never completely under control, but when did you feel like you had it under control? And then when did you feel like, because obviously Coach Wooten had been there for so long and the program's standards and ways of doing things and just the process that he had in place had been there for so long. When do you feel like your stamp was put onto the program? How many years into your tenure do you feel like the program sort of transitioned from being his, which it'll obviously, there'll always be a piece of it that's his, but absolutely, when do you feel like you were able to put your stamp on it and kind of say, oh, he did it this way, but maybe now we want to do it a slightly different way? When do you feel like you had that type of control over the program?
Well, I think one of the things is, when I first got the job, you know, there were plenty of college coaches and just basketball people that reached out to me to wish me luck and congratulate me on being named a coach. And I remember one of the letters that I remember most is I got a little card from Gary Williams up at the University of Maryland. And in the card, it said congrats. And then it says, you know, basically, Mike, do things your way. Like, don't try to be Coach Wooten. And like, it really, like, that has always stuck with me, because initially I did try to do everything just like Coach.
Right. Why wouldn't you? And, I mean, it makes total sense.
Yeah. But kids are too smart for that. Like, they know what's genuine. They know what's you. They know, like, just, hey, you're trying to be somebody that you're not. Like, in my personality, like, you have to coach to who you are. And I didn't do that initially. And I regret that. But I kind of grew into myself. So to be honest with you, I laughed when you first asked the question, because, I mean, you know, Victor Oladipo graduated in 2010. Coach Wooten retired in 2002. So at that point, when Victor graduated, I had been through two cycles of my kids, my recruits, you know, however you want to term that.
Right.
And then he's 3 years into school and he gets drafted in the 2013. And people wrote articles, played for Morgan Wooten at DeMath High School. And my family would be so upset. Like, they was just like, yo, like, this dude hasn't coached in 11 years. Like,
you're,
and
still taking credit for your NBA guys. Come on.
You know, that's funny. Like, honestly, and I said this at that time to my family, it never once bothered me. Like, it never once bothered me. It bothered them, but it never once bothered me. It was cool, because to me, that was a statement that DeMath hadn't changed, and the respect level and that Coach Wooten had earned. Like, people still think, you know, we're still ranked here. We're still producing players. And they haven't noticed that there's a new coach. And to me, that was really important, that some people that, you know, aren't, you know, in the Mathis community, like, they still thought the same. The great coach was still leading the program. And that meant a lot to me. So, but honestly, I don't know. I don't know if it's ever really gotten to that. I spoke at a coaching clinic and Bill Walton was there. And Bill Walton, I go introduce myself to him. And, you know, one of the first things is, how long has Coach Wooten been retired? And I still get that. I got this past weekend. Like, some people, like, it really has all run together. And to me, I'll call it justification or validation of what we've done.
Yeah, no greater testament to your success than that.
Yeah.
So let's take it one more question related to that before we jump into USA basketball, and that is, what do you attribute your ability to be able to continue that? Because I think, you know, as humble as you're being, to be able to continue the success beyond what Coach Wooten was able to do and then have it continue basically uninterrupted, what are some of the things that you feel are the strengths of you and your program that allow you to continue to have the success that you have today?
So personally, I'll say just the faith that I have. You know, again, I cannot stress it enough. I have been truly blessed. But the other thing, I mean, there's one common denominator, and that's the Matha, the school, the administration, the community that we're in. It is a tremendous place. And, you know, Coach Wooten was able to be so successful there with the support of the school and the administration. And yeah, I attribute it to the same thing. Like, we've been able to be successful post Wooten because of the school and the administration. We get great families. We get great kids, kids that are really good students. You know, we call ourselves, you know, we're a school full of faith-filled gentlemen and scholars. We add champions on the end of that, but they're young men who truly, we're a school of excellence. Our band program is one of the best in the country. We have other sports that are at the top of their game, you know, nationally recognized. Our science department is tremendous. Our English department is tremendous. Like, we have so many things at our school that they achieve a certain level. If you're a student at DeMatha, you're going to be surrounded by people that, you know, I might be a basketball player, but I'm sitting next to somebody that wants to be the best at whatever it is he likes, the best musician, or, you know, I want to be a businessman, or I want to be an engineer, or, you know, we've got five school buildings. Three of the school buildings at DeMatha were designed by a DeMatha graduate, an engineer that basically got his start in architectural drawing. Like, we're just at a place that I just think we breed that type of mindset.
Excellence surrounded by excellence, I mean, continues to push everybody higher. I think that's a great way of describing it.
And it's a competitive environment.
Yep.
Like, we all push. You know, I tell eighth graders all the time, when you sit in a DeMatha math class and you get your first quiz back, the first thing you're doing after you look at your grade is you're looking at the grades around you. Because, you know, it's not like some schools where, you know, you're trying to be cool by getting a C. It's like, no, like, there's no girls. You only have one thing to compete for, and that's, I want to get a better grade than a guy to my right, than a guy to my left.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I think that there's no doubt when you can put yourself into an environment where everybody around you wants to excel, that pushes, you know, everybody to greater heights. And, you know, again,
absolutely.
It's a testament to what you've been able to do that the programs continue to have the tremendous success that it's had, and I'm sure it's going to continue to have the same level of success. I want to jump, before we finish up, I want to be able to talk to you a little bit about USA Basketball and just how you got involved with all the guys at USA Basketball, and then what some of the experiences have been that you've had an opportunity to be involved with there.
I give credit where it's due. So my first appointment to USA Basketball was way back in 2004, after my second year as the head coach at DeMatha. And again, you know, we went 15-17 my first year, 19-11 my second year. So it's not like USA Basketball picked up something and said, oh my gosh, we got to go find this coach. I think the name DeMatha is what first attracted USA to me. So I was able to coach in the Youth Development Festival, where they used to have an East-West, North-South team. And my team, I was the assistant coach on the team with Herman Reed from Baltimore. We got the bronze medal, so it's not even like we dominated an opportunity I got. So in 2009, FIBA, the governing body for, you know, basketball across the world, decided to start the junior national team programs around the country and have a world championship competition. In 2009, there was a FIBA Americas and then other FIBA tournaments around the country for a 16-9. And then the following year, 2010, there was a world championship, and one was in Argentina for the FIBA Americas, and I believe the world championship was in Germany. And Quinn Cook was a point guard on my team back then, and he made the team. He was a starting point guard on the 16 and the 17 and under teams. I believe his success on the team, his demeanor, the way he carried himself, the leadership he brought, I believe he's the one that truly opened the door for me, because if he was doing all those things, they wanted whoever helped him get to that point. So the next cycle of 2011-2012, I was selected to be an assistant coach for Coach Joe Walter in the second cycle for the 16 and 17 and under teams. And after that, like, I honestly, it was such a great experience. I learned so much. So, like, I literally tried to do everything I possibly could to just stay involved. So, you know, they rotated the assistant coaches every year. And even when I wasn't a member of the staff, I would go out to be a core coach at training camp, or I would be at the mini camp in October. I would speak at the coaching clinics, and I just find any way, shape, or form for me to just stay, to the point where one year, one of the assistant coaches took a college job and they had to fill the spot like relatively quickly. So I got a phone call to be that person. And now, like, I've done something every single year with USA since 2010. So
that's very cool. I know that, you know, we've had a chance to talk to, you know, a bunch of guys, and obviously we've had Coach Showalter on too. And just, it just sounds like it's such a great experience for you guys as coaches. And then also just for the players to be able to come in and, you know, they're all sort of segmented across the country. I know they see each other at AAU tournaments and get a chance to compete with one another. But when they all kind of come together under that USA jersey, it just seems like it's a really special environment for everybody who gets a chance to set foot on the court, whether it's as a coach or as a player.
Well, to be honest with you, Mike, it's the leadership. Like, the, you know, from, you can go from Jim Tooley to Sean Ford, you know, the guys that run the whole entire organization. But, you know, when I first started back in 2010, BJ Johnson was the junior national team director. And, you know, he selected the players. He selected the coaches. Don Showalter, other than Coach Wooten, like, I wouldn't know who to compare him to. I mean, he is truly a great coach, not just a good coach, a great coach that teaches the game so well to coaches and players. And BJ Johnson took a job with as an NBA scout a couple of years ago, and the reins got handed to Samson Coyote. And Samson, I mean, Samson was the film guy my first round with USA back in 2011-2012. He was the guy that, you know, would go set up the film work, break down film and things like that. And now he's the junior national team director. He's great at it. I mean, his relationships with coaches, kids, his vision for the program, I mean, it's evolving with all the NCAA changes and things like that. USA Basketball is at the forefront of a lot of those things. And it's Samson's vision that's driving a lot of those things. I mean, it's truly just, I mean, any coach that has a chance to be a part of it, like, you just get so much out of it.
Yeah, it's exciting to see USA Basketball kind of taking the reins and sort of trying to lead basketball in the right direction, because we all know there's a lot of competing forces out there that maybe aren't always going in the right direction. And it's great to have the kind of leaders that USA Basketball has at the top to sort of to steer the ship in the right direction, so that we can make sure that the game is being taken care of the way that we all, everybody who loves it, like you and I do, and like Jason does, you know, just that the game's going to be going in the right direction. It's good to know it's in good hands, and hopefully they can continue to grow their influence, and we can get more coaches to get licensed and do all those things that continue to connect the coaches around the country to USA Basketball. And I certainly hope that that continues, and I think it will.
Yep. That's the plan.
Absolutely.
Could not be in better hands.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. All right, Mike, before we get out of here, we want to give you a chance to share your contact information for people who listen to the podcast. Maybe they want to reach out to you and ask a question or just say hello and thank you. So share out your contact information. If there's anything that we didn't hit on tonight that you want to talk about before we get out, go ahead and do that as well.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Again, thanks for the opportunity. You know, I try to be with the time, so to speak. My kids get on my case about it, but social media obviously is a huge thing. So on Instagram, the Math of Basketball page, myself and a couple other coaches just kind of run through that, but you can stay up to date, at least with pictures from our program, by just following the Math of Basketball. That's DEMATHA Basketball. On Twitter, I'm at the Math of Hoops on Twitter. That used to be the go-to for everything we do social media-wise. And then we also have a the Math of Hoops Facebook page. And then for any coach in the area or that finds himself in the D.C. area during the basketball season that wants to, you know, come maybe watch a practice or anything like that at DeMatha, my email is DeMathaBasketball@gmail.com. You can feel free to reach out there just to try to basically be able to watch. And we have had plenty of guys come through and watch. And, you know, we appreciate having eyes. And sometimes, you know, there's suggestions even given afterwards. And like, it all works out. Like, you know, we're all learning from each other. So, and then lastly, and I fully encourage any coach or anybody in the game of basketball to take advantage of the USA coaching that they hold throughout the spring and summer and fall. I'll be speaking at three of them this coming year, one in New York, one in Dallas, and then one here in D.C. If you go to usabasketball.com, the Coaching Academy dates are on there. They have one in Vegas, one in Atlanta, I believe one in L.A., but they have them all over the country. Like, and I strongly encourage coaches to take advantage, because you have some of the best from across the country participating in those. A lot of college coaches, sometimes you have pro coaches there, and then sometimes high school coaches. But you can just learn so much. And, you know, you see the hashtag grow the game all the time. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to grow the game as best as we possibly can. And, you know, things like that really help. So hopefully people can take advantage of that.
Yeah, no question about that. I got a chance and saw you speak in Cleveland last year, and that's where I actually met Greg White and Lindsey Huddleston. I got a chance to get them on the show, and now we've had a chance to have you on. And again, we can't thank you enough for taking an hour and 15 minutes out of your day to jump on with us, and we really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.